DeSantis claims victory. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. DeSantis and Florida Republicans passed four COVID-related bills last week. Some Democrats didn't even show up for the vote. We'll tell you what these laws mean for you. Also, the airlines are preparing for one of the busiest holiday seasons ever. We spoke with the head of the Miami International Airport about COVID expectations, travel tips this year, and why there are so many unruly passengers.
We've already surpassed the national average by more than 100%, so obviously it's a concern.
And a local artist brings a giant lit-up Florida Panther to Miami. And finally, Hialeah was considered the sport of kings, once a staple of Miami life. It's now a dying relic. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. A handful of bills restricting vaccine and mask mandates are now law in Florida. The three-day special legislative session from last week turned out to be a win for Governor Ron DeSantis and his efforts to fight federal COVID mandates. Where were Florida Democrats while Republicans were scoring these wins? Some Democrats were literally absent. Joining us now, Steve Bosquet is one of the Sun Sentinel editorial board and the paper's opinion editor. Steve, great to have you back.
Hey, Luis. Thank you. Good to see you.
So DeSantis signs four bills into law. What do they entail exactly?
The bills that passed the legislature prohibit the local governments and school boards from imposing mask mandates or vaccine mandates. They prevent private businesses from imposing vaccine mandates unless they offer a range of exemptions such as medical and religious reasons. They gave $1 million to the governor, the legislature did, to create a replacement agency for the federal agency for workplace safety known as OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And they passed a controversial public records exemption that keeps all employee complaints and all investigations of Florida companies secret.
That's it. I want to look at two of these specifically. Let's look at, the one where the governor creates an agency to oversee worker safety, again, to replace OSHA. First of all, is that even legal?
Yes, it is legal. I think last time I checked, 22 states have what are known as state-level OSHA agencies. However, as with almost everything, Luis, it's nowhere near as simple as Ron DeSantis and the legislature make it sound, starting with the fact that the federal government has to approve it. And as we've pointed out in editorials and opinion articles in the Sun Sentinel, we've raised the question of whether state government can be trusted to oversee workplaces and keep workers safe when we've had disasters in the state like the Piney Point phosphate leak over near Bradenton. We've got a history of abuses in the workplace against farm workers and dispossessed people all over the place. And I think it's unlikely that this replacement agency would ever be created. Well, by the way, the state nearest us that has this system is South Carolina.
And this all happened, again, because, again, federal reach to try to, it was because the federal government wanted government workers vaccinated, right?
That's right. In a larger political context, this session is about scoring points against Joe Biden and a Democratic administration in Washington, which is just going to feed more of the talk that Ron DeSantis wants to run for president, which he has said he has no intention of doing. So there's that. And he also said this. He said that the regular session of the legislature starts right after the first of the year. And so Democrats and others asked, what's the rush here? In a state with a huge unemployment problem, affordable housing crisis, a property insurance crisis that's getting worse, why was it necessary to meet so quickly on this issue? His answer is that mandates were due to take effect in some private employers or governments on January 1st, and he wanted to protect workers from being fired or losing their jobs. However, I'm not aware of him citing any specific case that applies. So that's why we had a special session.
Yeah. And of course, the regular session starts in January because next year is an election year. I wanted to get to the open records bill. And what was the response from First Amendment advocates about that one?
The First Amendment Foundation, which speaks for, is a watchdog group that speaks for most Florida news organizations, was strongly opposed to this bill, said it was overbroad, unnecessary. This public records exemption puts an awful lot of authority in the hands of the Attorney General, who, as everyone knows at the moment, is a highly partisan conservative Republican, Ashley Moody, who's running for re-election. And, you know, we're not going to know, you're not going to know if the restaurant down the street has a series of employee complaints about vaccinations or about unnecessary exposure to COVID. I think it's fair to assume that people are going to use this complaint process for lots of reasons, maybe good, maybe bad. But this is part of a much broader and much more troubling strategy we've seen over the past decade or longer to erode the public records laws in Florida.
And have we heard anything about this going to court?
No. I kind of think that that might be unlikely. It might take a triggering incident. These, if I'm not mistaken, these four laws are already in effect. Governor Ron DeSantis signed them last week at a car dealership in Brandon near Tampa, and they're already in effect. And so if an employee files a complaint with the Attorney General today about a vaccine mandate at their employer in Miami-Dade County, it's going to be secret. We're not going to know about it. There are so many other public records battles that are being fought on different, you know, places around the state, different battlegrounds, that I don't think this is one of the highest priorities for the news media.
And I mean, so this, because you're talking about, like, for example, like a restaurant or something like that. I mean, like, how far reaching is this? And, you know, like, will all information about COVID related, you know, cases or complaints basically be hidden?
I think they will be if they involve personal health information. Now, I want to clarify something. The news media in Florida is not interested in irresponsibly publishing personal health information of private citizens. What the news media is interested in doing is in holding businesses and governments accountable for their policies and job restrictions that relate to COVID-19 or another, you know, virus and another pandemic if one occurs. No one that I'm aware of predicted this was going to happen when and where it did. So it is too much of a blanket of secrecy over the businesses against whom these complaints will be filed.
So as I mentioned before, Democrats, it almost seemed like they didn't really push back. There were some who were absent, weren't they?
Correct. We wrote a story about it over the weekend in the Sun Sentinel. This, in my opinion, as an opinion columnist for my newspaper, this was unconscionable by Democrats to not show up and not put up a more forceful opposition to the public records exemption. The Democrats are in such dire straits politically in the legislature that the only thing they really have is a bully pulpit and the power of public opinion. They don't have the numbers. However, to enact a new public records exemption in Florida requires a two-thirds vote of both houses. That means 27 senators. There are only 24 Republicans. You can't enact a new public records exemption without some help from Democrats. And so I pose the question, why would Democrats lift a finger to help Republicans expand the level of secrecy in our state? It doesn't make any sense. And four senators were absent and did not vote on this bill on the floor. They are Lauren Book, who's the Democratic leader, who's from Broward, Loran Osley from Tallahassee, Randolph Bracey of Orlando, and Bobby Powell of Palm Beach County. They were absent for different reasons, but they didn't vote. And every time a Democrat doesn't show up, it makes the Republicans' job a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, I'd wondered the impact of their absence on this special session. Would it have made a difference?
Yes, it would have made a difference. I mean, if all four of them had shown up and voted no, The people who voted no on this bill were 10 Democrats, and they needed 14 to defeat this bill. Those four would have provided exactly that number, just enough votes to kill this bill. And so, you know, there are so few opportunities for the minority party to really take control of the agenda. And this was one, and it fell by the wayside. It doesn't bode well for the regular session in January, which is an election year.
And what does it say about the what does it say about the Democratic Party here in Florida, especially going into that session?
Well, you know, a two-party system, even in its somewhat weakened form, a two-party system is crucial to democracy working in this state and in this country. And that's two responsible and engaged parties that really care about looking out for the public. So it tells me that, you know, Democrats are in disarray. There's a lack of cohesion, and there does appear to be an unwillingness to want to fight enough fights with the Republican majority.
And Senator Book take charge of the caucus back in April, when they ousted Senator Farmer?
That's correct. And I would say this. I mean, Lauren Book appears to have the strong support of her colleagues as the caucus leader. And it's not an easy time for her or for the caucus. They're going into a redistricting year. Every Senate seat will be up. The Republicans are drawing the lines. So the maps and the Senate districts are going to look the way Republicans want them to look, not Democrats. It just adds to her challenges.
Something we'll bring up the next time we get her in here. Steve Bosquet, Sun Sentinel Editorial Board and the paper's opinion editor. Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you for the insight.
Okay, thank you so much.
And again, you can follow more of this story and Steve's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, why are people getting out of control when they fly? And what are airports like MIA doing about it? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The airlines are counting on a very busy holiday travel season, but air travel has become a bit of a challenge for everyone. Earlier this month, we saw hundreds of canceled flights due to a lack of employees, and we're seeing an increase in the number of unruly passengers, and by a lot. Earlier today, we spoke with Ralph Gutierrez. He is the director and CEO of the Miami-Dade Aviation Department. He oversees Miami International Airport. And we started by asking what the airlines are expecting for this holiday season.
I want to ask you about flight cancellations. I mean, we're coming up on the holiday season, and so there's concern. And we saw it at the end of October into the beginning of this month. A lot of flights canceled, really just a couple of airlines. But part of it, my understanding, was because there were not enough employees. What have you heard from the airlines as to how they've dealt with that? Can we expect more cancellations that are not weather related?
Right. Well, it's tough to predict. We have worked with the airlines, and I know, for example, American is adding, I can't give you the exact number. At one point, it was another 1,500 employees, but I know they're adding they're hiring back a significant number of employees, crew members, and stuff like that. So one of the things that's impacted them, obviously, aside from weather, as you mentioned, is crew shortages. So they've addressed that, and we're hoping that we will not have a problem these holidays. But if we do, you know, we'll work with them to work around them. Now, I can tell you, we have been very busy here at MIA. Yesterday, we had our busiest day since the pandemic started, and close to our busiest day ever. We had 159,000 passengers come through the airport yesterday, and we anticipate having an extremely busy Thanksgiving holiday season. We're projecting 11 or 12% over our numbers from 2019, which were record numbers to begin with. So far, so good as far as the airlines not canceling flights. But obviously, if something happens, we'll work together with them as we have in the past.
But how confident are you that you'd be able to get a flight this Thanksgiving?
Well, I can tell you, I have my son flying in this Wednesday, and his flight is okay. I mean, I will tell you, I'm pretty confident from my dealing with the airlines that I would be able to catch a flight if I had to leave here, if I had a reserve flight. So obviously, there's certain things we can't control. But right now, we're looking good as of today.
What are you doing? What is the airport doing to keep its employees feeling safe and satisfied at work?
Okay, so we have, obviously, we are subject to all the federal mandates regarding mask wearing. We strongly encourage our employees to get vaccinated. We have a very high vaccination rate from our county employees here at MIA. We have a very high vaccination rate. The mayor implemented back a couple of months ago a requirement for non-vaccinated employees that they need to get tested once a week. So they do that in order to keep us safe. Some people that can work from home, we still allow them to work partly from home, part-time. Obviously, the people that have to be here at the airport and have to be on duty because their job does not allow them to work from home, they work from home. We provide all the right safety equipment, masks, gloves for some of our maintenance employees. We also have, our employees get tested, obviously. One of the things we did during the pandemic, we actually implemented shift rotations to kind of allow our employees to maintain social distancing. So we took a lot of steps, high touch point cleaning. We're still doing that. And we did that at the start of the pandemic. So we've taken a lot of measures to make sure that our employees are safe. And so far we've been very successful as far as keeping our employees healthy.
What have you seen? Have you seen people in the airline industry and in working at airports say, you know what, I went out and they've left? Has that been the case?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think I can answer that. I mean, what I do know is, forget about the airline industry. I think overall, I think one of the things the pandemic has done, just from anecdotal stories that I hear from people, you know, friends and people on the outside, is that the pandemic has caused people to kind of reevaluate, their lifestyle, their work environment. I know some people that have decided as a result of the pandemic, they had to stay home. Some of them have started businesses that they can run from their house instead of punching a clock and working for someone else. So I think that's kind of, it's not an airline thing. I think it's an overall societal thing where a lot of people have just, the pandemic has made them reconsider how they run their lives, how they work, their work environments. This whole issue of working from home, I think has opened the door for a lot of people, especially in some of the technology industries where they have the ability to work from home and they're able to reevaluate how they live their lifestyle.
All right. I have to ask you about this. Reading, I saw that according to the Federal Aviation Administration, as of November 9th, there have been more than 5,100 cases of unruly passenger incidents. Now, I don't know if that's too high of a number considering how many people fly.
Sure, I can walk you through that.
Are things getting worse or is it just perception? Tell me.
No, I can tell you the honest truth because I'm unfortunately very familiar with these statistics. So first, let's establish a point of reference. The national average pre-pandemic nationwide was anywhere from 150 to 200 incidents, unruly passenger incidents a year. So let's take that number and marinate on that for a while. So between 150 and 200, that was the national average pre-pandemic. Currently, you're correct. At the latest numbers that I heard as of last week, we're nearing 5,300 unruly passenger incidents nationwide. Okay, so that's a more than 3,000% increase in those incidents. Now, here at MIA, we've already beat the national average. If you take the high end of that national average I mentioned, which is 200, we're already at about 450 in that neighborhood here at MIA. So we've already surpassed the national average by more than 100%. But nationwide, we are more than 3,000. It's a more than 3,000% increase. Well, so obviously, it's a concern.
Let's start with this, Ralph. What do you think is causing this?
I think it's a combination of things. And I'll give you just my personal opinion. One, that what the FAA has told us is that about 80% of these cases are related to just mask wearing. People refusing to wear masks or tired of wearing masks. And obviously the FAA still continues to maintain its mandate that if you ride on an aircraft, if you go in an airport, you have to wear a mask. So 80% of the cases, plus or minus estimated, are related to mask wearing. Now, fold into that as well, I think if you ask me my personal opinion, when people have been cooped up for so long and not been able to travel or get out of their house, I think that produces a certain amount of stress in people. So when they get to the airport, sometimes that, maybe anxiety and that kind of thing has something to do with it. And also, obviously, alcohol. When people come to any airport, not just ours, and they have too much to drink, and then they get impatient at the lines, and you have all these other factors. You have to wear a mask. You have to social distance, that kind of thing.
I'm speaking with the director and CEO of the Miami-Dade Aviation Department, Ralph Gauthier. He oversees MIA, Miami International Airport. We're talking about holiday travel this Thanksgiving weekend and how not to be an unruly flyer. Do you have confidence that you can make your flight? Let us know on social media at WLRN Sundial. Should we consider not selling alcohol? Should you consider, since you're already checking people, you have to check. I mean, at one point we were checking temperatures, and we do have to go through the TSA line. Should we check passengers to see what their alcohol level is?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Well, one of the things, like, I'll tell you what we've done. Whether or not can we stop selling alcohol, I don't think that's a realistic thing to do. However, what we can do is what we're doing here as an example. We have our police officers that do last call patrols at some of our concessionaires. So that's one thing we do. We've also worked with our concessionaires to ask them to please be more vigilant as far as the clients that they serve. Same way you would in a bar. I'm not a big drinker, but the same way you would in a bar outside of the airport. If you're a bartender and you see that somebody's had too much, you stop. You stop serving them.
So,
and we've worked with our concessionaires to have them curtail their sales when they see somebody that, you know, maybe they've had enough. But I don't think prohibiting the sale of alcohol, I don't think will be a realistic thing.
In the end, who's really responsible for dealing with this? The FAA, the airlines, the airport? I mean,
to be honest with you, Lewis, I think it's all of us. I think it's a team effort. It's the FAA, it's airline employees, it's airport employees, it's the police department, it's our concessionaires. There's no one, I don't think there's any one person. I mean, it's a combination of things that are leading to these incidents. And I think we all have to work together to get past it. And hopefully, once we get back to normal,
should we just get rid of the mask mandates? If that's the biggest issue, should we just get rid of them?
Well, I mean, that's an excellent question. Obviously, it's a fine line because the pandemic, although our numbers are much lower, I mean, it's still around. You have this D variant. And my understanding is there may be some other variant out there. So for now, those mandates are here to stay. How long that's going to be for, I don't know. I mean, the FAA is going to be reevaluating that in January, I believe. So they're supposed to be coming out with some additional guidelines in January. But should we do away with the mask? I mean, I'm not sure. That's not my call. Again, it's a fine line between keeping people healthy and keeping people from getting sick and having another spike in the virus and, you know, limiting these unruly passenger incidents. I mean, at the end of the day, it's personal behavior. You know, I think people have to take responsibility for their own behavior. But I think we've done a very good job here at MIA, and our police department has done yeoman's work. I'm very proud of the work they do every day. I mean, they handle all of our unruly passengers with respect. They employ all the right de-escalating techniques that they receive in training. One of the things we're doing that the mayor asked us to move forward on, we're going to be we're working together with the county's community services agencies to provide training or establish a training program for all of our civilian staff. In other words, all of our non-police staff in de-escalation techniques and how to handle unruly people, et cetera. So we're taking steps on our end to improve the situation. But at the end of the day, obviously, it's a personal code of conduct. People have to take responsibility for their own behavior. Hopefully, it'll get better once we get through the pandemic and we kind of move forward. You know, things will all die down some. But well, right now, you know, it's at a peak.
I think about what you said. The number is sitting with me. You go from a couple hundred to over 55. No, that's – I wanted to go back to the county commission and the recent decision they had that was – to look at how to work with and help the business tenants there and also the workers and their wages. Just remind us of what happened and what's happening with the businesses that have spaces in the airport and how they were impacted by the pandemic.
Okay, obviously the pandemic had a significant impact on all of our businesses here at the airport. We had at one point, probably in the height of the pandemic, we were down to about 4,000 passengers a day, anywhere from 4,000 to 7,000 passengers a day. So to give you an idea of the kind of impact that you know, what that entails is typically we get an average of 125,000 to 135,000 passengers a day average. And then obviously we have our summer and holiday peaks, which are much higher. So when you go down to 4,000 to 7,000, that's a major impact. So when you don't have passengers coming through the airport, obviously that impacts our businesses. So a lot of businesses had to close. Some of them had to lay off employees, et cetera. So it was a financial impact to them. Well, the Board of County Commissioners, and it was actually the chairman's policy committee of the board, what they considered last week was the mayor's negotiated relief package for our businesses, which struck a balance between what the businesses were asking for and what we and the airlines could deal with financially. So that's what was presented to the chairman's policy committee. It's going to go now to the full Board of County Commissioners on December 1st. And what that does, and I don't want to get into too many details, but it's going to extend the contracts for a lot of these businesses. And it's also going to provide relief in certain areas. It's going to provide for some of them tiered rent and some other relief to allow them the opportunity to kind of catch up and to recover from the impact that they felt from the pandemic.
The other thing, too, that the mayor had wanted was to look at wages.
The actual relief package also includes a living wage. So it requires all of our tenants, all of our concessionaires to pay living wage to all of their employees. It requires that. And it also requires, it's got labor peace provisions in there as well. So
there was a concern, I think, right by the airlines that if you were going to do that, that perhaps, and any kind of relief for the businesses, that there might be price increases that could hurt customers. How has that been dealt with?
Well, one of the items that the board is considering that is included in the relief package is, as far as competitive pricing, currently the packages as they stand included eliminating the competitive pricing provisions in these contracts, which would mean that some of these firms could charge a little bit more. Obviously, this will be regulated. It will be market regulated. But again, that has not been finally considered. This will go to the full board. And at that point, you know, that and the rest of the package will be discussed again.
So for this upcoming holiday, you know, you have Thanksgiving and then Christmas. We're still, as you said, in the pandemic. So COVID protocols, you know, but what can they expect over this next month and a half?
The most important thing, I think, is people have to try to plan ahead. For example, if you're going to fly out on a domestic flight, try to be here more than 2 hours in advance. You know, this thing of coming in at the last second, that's going to just create, with the lines we're going to have and the amount of passenger traffic we're going to have, I don't think is going to be a good thing. So what we're letting people know is, if you're going to fly domestic, try to get here more than 2 hours in advance of your flight. If you're going to fly international, try to be here 3 hours in advance of your flight. Some of the other things we're asking people to do is, since our garages are going to be pretty full, if you can take some kind of rideshare service, a taxi, or the Metrorail Orange Line to get to the airport, that would help too, because that'll lessen the burden on our garages. The mask mandates are still in effect. And like I said before, the TSA is going to be reevaluating that sometime in January. And at that point, we'll see what happens. But for now, the full mask mandates are in effect. So you have to wear them on your aircraft and you have to wear them here at the airport. And it will be enforced. We're going to have police officers and agents out there reminding people in a very friendly way to keep their masks on.
Again, that was Ralph Coutier, director and CEO of the Miami-Dade Aviation Department. He oversees Miami International Airport. And if you're traveling by plane this holiday season, what are you most concerned about? Or maybe you just found another way to travel, or maybe you're just not going to travel because you don't want to deal with it. Share with us your story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And by the way, if you're going to fly, stay calm, stay cool. Seriously, we're all on that plane together. Still to come, artist Carlos Betancourt is bringing a giant Florida panther to the Miami skyline. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Right by Bayfront Park, you have the Intercontinental Hotel, and there's this familiar display. You've probably seen it, the Dancing Lady in Lights. She's been dancing for us since December of 2012. And if you've driven by or looked up recently, you may have noticed something different. The lady's gone. Instead, you see Florida panthers. Carlos Betancourt is the Miami-based artist behind the work. The display is called Into the Everglades, and it's currently on display through November 29th. It's to raise awareness of the need to protect Florida's endangered species. Now, we spoke with Carlos recently and Tori Linder. Tori is the director of the Path of the Panther. That's an initiative supported by National Geographic. Path of the Panther worked with Carlos to bring the project to the Miami skyline. Carlos, this piece is a big jump from what I've seen of your work. What inspired you?
Yes, indeed. It's a big jump, and it's a big a platform. It's a big screen. What inspired me was a visit to the Everglades with Path of the Panther. And I think the part that was really helped me translate, bring this message of conservation of the Everglades into the urban area was a moment that Tori and her team with National Geographic took me through an area in a Quartz Crew sanctuary, which is not far from my house in Miami. Ironically, it's an hour and a half into this magical world. So it was a moment that I was shown the cameras that are placed in this path, the Path of the Panther, and the camera screen had captured a panther just a couple of days before. And that moment of realization that I was right in the spot where these mythical creatures roam, you know, was quite beautiful.
The side of the Intercontinental Hotel, which has, you know, the famous dancing lady on it, and now it's going to have this display. And as you said, it's old school, so you had to kind of teach yourself a new system in order to create that visual. Just briefly, what is that visual going to be? What are we going to see?
It opens with a moonrise. It's a very personal emotion I have with Miami and that movie Moon Over Miami. This is Moon Over the Everglades. It's a place that kind of like unifies us all, you know, when you look up into the cosmos. And I imagine the Everglades at night. My first experience actually with the Everglades was with Halley's Comet when it came back. I think I was around 19 and I went there and I'll never forget the starry night. I think it was even more impressive that Halley's Comet. It was so dark and beautiful and the sounds. So somehow, personally, I always relate to the Everglades at night. We go into birds, we go into alligators that kind of like are downloaded from the sky right into downtown Miami. That's the way I like to look at it, no? And we have a family of panthers that mark that Path of the Panther and alludes to the corridor that we're trying here to create awareness and protect, which is a place where the panthers roam and humans as well. It's like the intersection for all of us. And I think we're a little bit disconnected from the Everglades. But once you introduce or reintroduce people into that world, you can't help but embrace it because it's so beautiful. And for me, yeah, it's vast.
We live next to this place, and maybe oftentimes we forget it. Tori, Path of the Panther's tagline is telling the story of the Florida Panther and the land that it needs to survive. What was the impetus for this collaboration with Carlos?
Absolutely. So our team has been working here in South Florida for the past 4 years to tell the story of the Florida Panther really with hope of inspiring protection of its habitat, the Florida Wildlife Corridor. We often seek opportunities to not just share the science and data, which can really inspire minds towards protection, but also through art and story and engage with people to help win over hearts for our natural world.
You know, we talk about putting up this piece on this screen, which again is known for the dancing lady. Tori, why there? Why not something else? Why not a painting on a wall like in Wynwood or something else?
You know, these wild lands, this green infrastructure that sustains our life here in Miami is hidden in plain sight. We pass the 4 million contiguous acres of public lands that buffer our city often as we're traveling on I-75 or in or out of Homestead. But we don't often connect the dots with how exactly it is they sustain our urban core. The Intercontinental Miami's iconic walls really bring that opportunity to celebrate wild Florida across our entire skyline. And we could not be more excited to be bringing this message here.
You know, Tori, I wondered, you know, sharing the story of the Florida Panther, if that story changes when you go outside of Florida. I don't know if you try to tell that story anywhere else. Is it different?
as we've shared this story over the last couple of years, we've seen so much enthusiasm from here in Florida, but also from people around the globe. In March, there was a feature in National Geographic magazine by my colleague Carlton Ward Jr. and Doug Main, really telling the story of the recovery of the Florida panther, which is a remarkable one. It's one of the only big cats across the globe, making a comeback at this moment in time. And we were so encouraged to see the outpour of support and interest from people not just across the country, but across the world. If I may also add, you know, we've seen tremendous progress here in Florida, thanks to the story of the panther this year. We passed the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act with bipartisan unanimous support. And we were so encouraged to see legislation that really incentivizes our state policymakers and decision makers to prioritize connection and preservation of these lands as they're making decisions for the future of our state. And we hope it also inspires other states to follow suit.
And I do want to ask you about some of the things that lawmakers are doing in that area. But Carlos, coming back to you, for you as an artist, how do you approach something this big?
I wasn't intimidated at first, but then I was. We worked in a small screen, and I worked with a very talented young artist, Amelie Cohen, that helped me translate what was in my mind's eye into a video, no? We had much more limitations than we thought, and the dancing lady and dancing man, they taught me a lot because I learned that movement in the screen was key. Understanding why is it that the dancing figures are so popular and they work with the screen helped me develop the technical aspect of it. The palette as well was very important. We're trying to go into a magical night scene world of greens and blues, and some of those colors didn't read well. I was forced to go to places that I'd never been to, and that's okay. We look for moments like that.
I'm speaking with Miami-based artists Carlos Betancourt and Tori Linder from the Path of the Panther Initiative. Together, they're bringing new artwork to light up the Miami skyline on the side of the Intercontinental Hotel. The Into the Everglades display is up through November 29th, and you can find out more about the work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Tori, what's really interesting in listening to what he's saying, you know, you don't see Florida panthers in an area like this. It is right next door. I mean, the Everglades are right there, but we don't see them. Why is it important to put it in the minds of Miamians?
It brings a reminder of the scale of territory that the species needs to survive. A male panther requires 200 square miles of breeding range. That's an area four times the size of the city of Miami. And their survival is dependent on this network of private and public lands spanning from Florida Bay in the south to the Georgia and Alabama borders called the Florida Wildlife Corridor. The corridor encompasses 17.7 million acres, 9.6 million acres are already protected, and 8.1 million acres of remaining opportunity areas do not yet have conservation status. We are excited to engage the residents of Miami in conversation and action.
And you mentioned it earlier. I wanted to ask you about that earlier this year, Governor DeSantis signed the Florida Wildlife Corridor Act into law, and that designates $300 million for acquiring land. How does your initiative, Path of the Panther, see this impacting the species?
Yes, the long-term recovery of the Florida panther is going to be dependent on protecting this network of lands through the state. We've seen the species make a remarkable recovery in Southwest Florida from a historic low of about 30 individuals. They're up to over 200 today. But But that population has been primarily, exclusively really in Southwest Florida and our stronghold of public lands there, Big Cypress, Everglades National Park, the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. And now we need to protect the mosaic of lands, the working lands, the timberlands, the ranch lands that connect these large parks and protected areas to ensure that the Florida panther has continued room to roam as it recovers.
This is a fascinating project. I'm looking forward to seeing this up on the big screen, of course, and you know, just something to remind people, as Carlos beautifully put earlier, that all of this is right there, right next to us, you know, if we ever want to just turn around and take a peek at it. But Tori, Carlos, I want to thank you so much for the time to share this with us, and again, looking forward to seeing this beautiful project up on in Miami's skyline.
Thank you so much, Lewis. We're really looking forward to sharing Florida's hidden wild with our city.
Thank you, Lewis, for this opportunity.
And again, you heard Carlos Betancourt. He's the Miami-based artist behind Into the Everglades, again on display through November 29th. And that was Tori Linder, director for Path of the Panther. And again, learn more about this project on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So the last game of Hi-Li in Dania Beach is coming up soon, November 28th. After almost 70 years in the Fronton, this is the last scheduled game. Hi-Li was once a huge sport in South Florida and was even highlighted in the intro to the show Miami Vice. But those days are long in the past. So we're reintroducing you to someone whose life has revolved around this very Floridian corner of the sports world.
Somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, you heard the news?" And I was like, "No, what's going on?" They said, "Oh, Hi-Li's done for good." Because, I mean, I knew that Hi-Li was coming to an end at some point. I thought maybe we had another year or so to enjoy it. But then when I heard that at the end of November was going to be the real final date, that's when it really, you know, sunk in and hit me pretty hard. I've actually been working at the building for more than half my life. First name Ryan and the last name Esdale. I turned 30 on July 1st of this year.
My name is Ryan Esdale. I'm 17 years old and I'm an announcer at Dania Hi-Li. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Dania Hi-Li. The players salute you for game one, a spectacular seven doubles match. Serving in the red shirt.
The thing I like about this sport is the speed of the game, but I have a long history with the sport.
Calling the judges in to let them know the game was about to begin. Then I start the music, which brings out the players.
My parents actually met at Dania Hi-Li a long time ago. So if you think about it, without the building, I wouldn't even be alive. My dad still goes daily to place his wagers. He bets the same numbers that he has for as long as I've known. And he still is very lucky with those sets of numbers that he plays even to this day. It doesn't matter who the players are. He still comes out ahead. I don't know how he does it. And my mom, she used to be a cocktail waitress at the casino. Well, it wasn't even a casino. It was just Hi-Li back then. And now she still comes and she's enjoying the casino side of the building, but she still likes to come and watch Hi-Li as well. There's not many people that work in the building as long as I have. We only have a couple left. They call me one of the originals.
When I first started coming to Hi-Li, there used to be a height restriction on what you have to be to come in here, and I didn't meet that requirement. So my parents would sometimes stuff my shoes with napkins or fluff my hair to make me tall enough to reach that little blue line that got you the permission to get in here.
I was a referee. I was even a food runner for the food stands. I was a poker chip counter. And then I became a greeter. They turned me into an MC for the promotions on the stage. Now I'm a casino host. I'm like the middleman. I make sure I'm in the middle and put everyone happy. And that's where I like to be, you know? I like to see people enjoying their experience at Dania. And I wouldn't change that job for the world. We have a lot of retirees that come to our casino. Everybody looks at me like, you know, the part of their family, like I'm one of their grandchildren sometimes. I always hear the same stuff. This place used to be the greatest. Everybody always talks about how the stands were filled with 5,000 people watching the game. But then again, at the same time, they say, well, that was the only choice they had. There really was no casino. when I drove into work yesterday, I literally thought to myself, wow, there's going to be Hi-Li going on tonight. Whenever I'm working and I don't have to do something for a couple of minutes, I make sure that if I walk by and I see Hi-Li going on and I'm right by the Fronton area, I'll make sure I stop in for at least a couple minutes per night just to get my Hi-Li fix in, because I know I won't be able to do that much longer and I got to take advantage of the time while I can. It was shocking to me that we kept on going and going and going, and I am grateful for the many years after that I was able to still see the sport and enjoy it. But hey, what can we do? We saw the best. We saw the best. When you listen to a traditional Hi-Li ball against the traditional granite wall, there's no comparison. The clacking of the sound of the ball is just, that's Hi-Li. That's real Hi-Li. You know? And when you go over to the other Fronton with a glass court, it sounds like you're listening to a mush ball playing racquetball. You know what I'm saying? That's the new modern version of what Hi-Li has in store. And, you know, it's better than nothing. I was actually between 6 and 7 years old. I got a customized cesta made for me. It was so small.
The cesta is the tool we use as Hi-Li players to throw the pelota. Pelota is the ball used in the sport of Hi-Li.
And I was able to learn how to throw the ball on like either the side of my house. And then I moved up to the side of Publix, in the back wall of Publix. And then I moved on to a racquetball court. And then finally, my dad took me to the North Miami amateur court where the amateurs learn how to play.
When I decided to become pro, I was about 12 or 13. My dad had a contract to play in Palm Beach Hi-Li back when they were open. And they happened to close right when he got the contract, so he didn't get to play. So I'm sure if I got to play at Dania, that would somehow fulfill something that he would want to do. He'd be proud of me for that.
And then sure enough, I went on to the big courts, and finally started winning tournaments. When I went to college at UCF in Orlando, I was lucky enough to be taken onto the roster for 2 seasons. And there was nights where I would win 3 games in a row. So that pretty much made my whole career. You know, I was studying and playing Hi-Li on the weekends. I couldn't have asked for more. I can't believe that I'm actually going to be witnessing the final days of the sport coming up so soon. It makes you realize you can't take things for granted, especially something that you would think that it's going to last a long time, a sport. But no, not even a sport can last forever. I will be there for the final performance. I'll have to let my boss know and put me aside for a few hours. I'm going to be in the Fronton. I'll always live by those memories and all the days that I got to play. It's in my blood forever, no matter what happens.
Our lead producer, Katie Munoz, produced this piece with Alicia Zuckerman. That audio from when Ryan Esdale was 17, that's from a 2009 piece that was produced by Trina Sargalski for an old WLRN program, Under the Sun. Now, you could hear the full original story and see photos on WLRN.org, and you could still go see Hi-Li in Dania Beach until that last game, which is November 28th. Well, that's our program for this Monday, November 22nd. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor, Peter J. Merritt. Today, Richard Ives, pushing all the buttons. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gobalo.com. Don't forget, this is a podcast too, so if you missed any of the show, you can listen tonight at 8 for the replay or find us on your podcast app. Just look up WLRN Sundial. Well, coming up tomorrow on the show, there's the old saying of not talking about politics or religion at Thanksgiving at the dinner table. What about vaccines and masks? I'm willing to bet probably not. We'll check with an etiquette expert to help us figure out how to handle these delicate pandemic disagreements around the holiday table. And also, by the way, share with us, you know, how you handle the difficult subjects around the holidays. You know, again, just find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'd love to hear that from you. Also, we're going to check in with Feeding South Florida about who in our community needs food. And we're not just talking about this week. All of that tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.